Welcome to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For more information, check out nhhca.org. Well, Paul is off this week as he is vacationing. It's school vacation week here in the southern portion of New Hampshire. So, Paul, not with us this week, but we have a great show planned for you. Before he left, we talked with Tim Ryan, congressman from Ohio, who is looking at running for president, was here in New Hampshire for 3 days of meetings. Also, Eric Swalwell, congressman from California, was in the Granite State, did politics and eggs on Monday and sat with me inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. That conversation comes your way in just a little bit here on the program. But first, a sit-down interview with Elizabeth Warren. She was in New Hampshire this past weekend. She included her first retail stops here in the Granite State as she toured downtown Laconia and sat down with me at the Wayfarer Coffee Shop. That comes your way in just a little bit. Of course, Bernie Sanders officially into the race, and Joe Biden is inching closer to getting in as well, with reports that he has been reaching out to individuals who could potentially be on his staff here in New Hampshire and in other early primary states. House Speaker Steve Shurtleff, who was a supporter of Vice President Biden's presidential campaign 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago in the 2008 cycle, says he's hearing that it's pretty much all systems go for Biden and about 90% chance that he gets in. So it looks like the vice president will be getting in, and Beto O'Rourke maybe as well. But for the rest of the program today, we'll focus on those individuals who are in the race or are looking at getting into the race more recently here in New Hampshire. We return on Background, my conversation with U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat from Massachusetts. So this segment here on Background, we head out onto the road into Laconia as we sit down with U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democratic candidate for president, officially into the race. On Background, of course, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. So we are out on the road here in this portion of the New Hampshire Now program in Laconia at a really cool coffee shop called The Wayfarer. So we're joined by Elizabeth Warren, campaigning here in the Granite State. And as we talk to you here for this first conversation, I'm really intrigued as to, you know, the rationale for pursuing the office. There's so many progressive candidates. Bernie Sanders got in. What differentiates you from the others in terms of knowledge base and skill set to be the candidate when all is said and done?
So the things that I'm in this fight for, a country that works not just for a thin slice at the top, but for everyone, has been pretty much my life's work. Mm. When starting, decades ago, I focused all of my work around what's happening to America's middle class, what's happening to working families across this country. Why is it that families that work hard, that play by the rules, are finding the path rockier and steeper every year, and people of color find it even rockier and even steeper? You know, I'm a person who was really blessed by opportunity. When my family hit the rocks back when I was a little girl, my mama was 50 years old. She never worked outside the home. Mm-hmm. She got a minimum wage job, and that minimum wage job saved our house. It saved our family. But it was at a time when a minimum wage job in America would help you. You could pay a mortgage. You could cover the utilities. You could put food on the table. Today, a mama who works every bit as hard as mine did can't keep herself and a baby out of poverty on the minimum wage. And the reason for that is because the rules written in Washington, when I was little, were about what does it take a middle-class family to survive. Now it's all about what improves the profitability of giant multinational corporations.
It seems expenses are very often forgotten in terms of the challenges of the individual today, and whether it's a middle-class individual or a individual who's trying to work their way out of poverty, the expenses are incredibly high. The wages have been stagnant for a while, but obviously that needs to be addressed, whether it's what you're proposing in regards to raising the federal minimum wage or other avenues. But the expenses, how do you address that?
So I use the minimum wage story as just a way to understand who government's working for, but boy, you just hit the nail on the head. So look at it this way. Right now, wages adjusted for inflation have been flat basically since the 1970s, late 1970s. Cost of housing adjusted for inflation is up two-thirds. Health insurance premiums have more than doubled. Cost of going to school up more than tripled. And today, in America, about 40% of America couldn't find $400 to cover an emergency. That is a shift, a powerful shift in America, and that's something we need to attack head on. So I have proposed a child care bill that would provide universal child care and early learning experiences for 0 to 5. And the way I look at that is that reduces one of the biggest costs that young working families encounter. Today, in New Hampshire, for example, the typical couple spends about 20% of their income on child care. I mean, try making that work, you know, in terms of expenses. So I've got a bill fully paid for. No working family will pay a dime more in taxes that will give us this opportunity for our kids. But housing is another part of this. We need to make significant investment in housing, not at the top end, but for working families, for middle-class families, for people with disabilities, so that people have an opportunity to live in decent housing and not pay an arm and a leg for it.
So I have a question. I was listening to you speak earlier today at the House party in regards to the ultra-millionaires tax. And I agree that we need to find a way to make individuals at the top pay more. I disagree in terms of the how you go about doing that. I think that you use the tax code in order to incentivize individuals to invest, because the concern I have is that individuals, as you well know, who are ultra wealthy have and will execute the ability to circumvent the tax code. And if you raise taxes on individuals making $50 million in assets or higher, assets will move, wealth will move.
And move where?
Off overseas.
Excuse me, this bill covers wherever you hold it. Does it make
so
any difference?
Everywhere.
Oh, it covers everywhere.
So
does it make any
does,
difference whether it's in the United States or you hold it in Switzerland or you hold it in the Cayman
but
Islands?
But you have to be a U.S. citizen?
If it's for U.S. citizens.
What if they
renounce their citizenship?
Correct.
They pay a 40% tax to renounce their citizenship.
Okay.
And most experts say they're not going to do that because there are too many advantages to citizenship. I have built into this tax bill enforcement.
Yep.
Recognizing that the 75,000 richest families in America can afford to hire some of the best lawyers in America and tax planners. But that's the advantage to making it, in effect, pretty flat. It just says all of your assets, 2%. There's no, but if you hold this and if you don't hold that, and here's a loophole and here's another twist, it doesn't try to create incentives. What this is about, it says, if you have built one of the biggest fortunes in America, you got to kick a little back in to create opportunities for the next kid. Mm. You got to kick a little back in so there's opportunity for the next child. These are people who got rich, and God bless them. I have no doubt. Some of them inherited, some of them worked hard. But they also benefited from being right here in America. They benefited from your investment in infrastructure, in education, in fire departments, in police departments. They benefited from those things, and all we're asking is put 2% back in, and that will produce enough revenue to cover universal child care and early learning for 0 to 5 for every single child in this country, and with $2 trillion left over.
Briefly, will that be your top priority? Because it will take, in order to keep all the provisions that you're describing within the bill, it will require, obviously, a huge amount of public sentiment and the bully pulpit of the presidency to allow for that to pass, given the stakes.
So, look, is universal child care right at the top of my list? You bet it is. But let me be clear about the big structural change around this. We got to do something about the fact that Washington keeps working for the billionaires and the giant corporations. When we do that, when we attack the corruption of money head on, we not only have a chance to do universal child care and housing, we also have a chance to take on a genuine clean new deal. We have a chance then to take on gun safety. We have a chance to take on all of the issues that right now big money, big corporate money, billionaire money, it blocking us from doing. We have a problem in this country, and it's not just one-off pieces. It's the fact that Washington is way too beholden to the billionaires and the giant corporations. This is our moment, our chance to change that.
You've discussed reparations for slavery as well as to Native Americans. What would that look like, and how would you go about distributing that?
So America needs to confront its ugly history of slavery and the long-term generational impact of that. There are a lot of different proposals that are out on the table right now and that different people have developed. A lot of scholars have been working on this. And I think it's time to have that conversation, to confront it head on.
Do you think it should go to individuals? Should it go to communities?
I think this is part of what the conversation is about right now. And a lot of different folks who are talking about it. For Native Americans, that we have to remember, tribes are different from each other. There is no single unitary answer here. And the principal thing that we should be talking about is honoring trust and treaty obligations that the United States government negotiated with different tribes. I think that's the right place to start with our tribal nations. And anything that affects tribal people, the tribal nation should be at the table. It's a government-to-government relationship with Native American tribes.
Do you, I was curious in, when the DNA test was rolled out and so forth, do you identify as being a Native American in terms of it being a part of your cultural identity, but not in terms of being your predominant identity? How would you categorize it?
I grew up out in Oklahoma. And I learned about my family the way most people learn about their families, from my mom and my dad and my aunts and my uncles. And I love my family. And based on my family's stories decades ago, I sometimes identified as Native American. My family history never had anything to do with any job I got. That's been fully documented. But even so, I shouldn't have done it. I am not a person of color. I am not a citizen of a tribe. Tribes and only tribes determine tribal citizenship.
Right.
I try to be a good friend to Native American tribes, and that's why I'm working, for example, on a bill on housing that not only puts more housing into urban and rural areas around the country, but specifically into honoring our obligations to tribal nations. It's a reason that I worry and work on tribal sovereignty when we talk about funding programs like opioids, not just to send money to the states, but to send some of that money directly to tribal governments that are on the front lines dealing with these issues. I think that's what it means to be a good friend.
In conclusion with Elizabeth Warren, you talk obviously a lot about domestic policy and domestic issues based upon your expertise, but obviously a huge part of being president is being commander-in-chief. I'm curious as to what your vision of America's role in the world is.
So I've been on Senate Armed Services Committee for a while now and have traveled around the world with different leaders from the Senate. I remember when I was in Afghanistan with John McCain. It was a year ago, last summer, I think. In fact, I think it may have been his last trip before he fell ill. And it was a place where you saw firsthand the consequences of America going into a war without a clear vision of how we were going to get out on the other side, without a clear vision of what constitutes success. So that today we are in our 17th year in Afghanistan, and the government of Afghanistan controls less than 60% of the territory. The opium crops continue to flourish. There are multiple terrorist groups throughout the region. The government does not have the confidence and support of many of the people. So I use that as an example of how America can't approach every problem as a military problem and ask our troops to go in without a clear vision of the objective and a plan for how we get out on the other side.
So you would not be afraid to use the military, but you would want to have clear objective.
Look, all three of my brothers were in the military. My eldest brother, Don Reed, 288 combat missions in Vietnam. I understand that our military are the best on earth, and they will do whatever we ask them to do. But that puts on us a responsibility to use them carefully and to use them in conjunction with the other tools available to us, the tools of diplomacy, the tools of the economy. We need to work together. And I'll put one more piece in, the importance of allies. Now, everything we do around the globe now is, if we can work with our allies, our European allies, our Canadian allies, our Asian allies, we have a better chance of success. Picking fights with our allies doesn't benefit us, and it doesn't make us any stronger. So I believe in using all of the tools in the toolbox and doing it with our allies whenever possible.
Senator Warren, great first conversation.
Oh,
great to meet
good.
You. Appreciate it. And we'll see you again soon. Thank you,
Chris.
That is U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren at the Wayfarer Coffee Shop in Laconia. I am Chris Ryan. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Paul Steinhauser off this week in terms of sitting in for the show, but was with me for our conversation with Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio.
We are honored to be joined on the program right now by Congressman Tim Ryan from the great state of Ohio. We've talked with him before, and he is in the Granite State looking at running for President of the United States. So, Congressman, how are you?
I'm doing great. Good morning.
Appreciate you joining
us for the show.
So talk a little about where you're at in that decision-making process. Is this something that you're going to want to do?
You know, we're getting close to making a decision. I'm very concerned about where the country is right now. I don't think we have a long-term game plan. We're divided, and I'm really concerned about it. And that's why I have the interest I have. I mean, I represent an area in Northeast Ohio, Youngstown, Akron, old industrial towns, and you know, towns like this all over the country need plugged in, and we're not getting plugged in, and the tax cut didn't work, and the volatility and division is killing us. And so we're getting close to making a decision on whether or not I think I can make a difference.
Well, let's talk about that, because last time we sat down with you was at the Red Arrow Diner just
before
the midterms.
Great pancakes.
Yep, you were hanging out with Annie Custer as she was running for re-election. But I got to ask you, I mean, time's wasting. We got a lot of candidates in the race already. Bernie Sanders just jumped in, raised an eye-popping $6 million in the first 24 hours.
Yeah.
So what's the holdup, and what are going to be the deciding factors for you to either, get in or not get in?
I mean, I'm not feeling any urgency. I think we're in a new reality with social media. And, you know, you look at Bill Clinton got in, I think someone told me, in like October. So, you know, it's kind of turned into a thing. Especially with President Trump, because the Democrats are so energized and excited to try to beat him. I think people have jumped in. But I think there's plenty of time to get to know people in Iowa and New Hampshire and the early states and raise the kind of money you would need. And, you know, so, yeah, I mean, I think you got to make a decision here soon, but I'm not feeling like, you know, we missed the opportunity.
Is there room for two candidates from Ohio? We just had Sherrod Brown in the state, and he looks like, you know, it looked like he was moving towards that as well. Can there be two from Ohio?
Yeah, he talks about a lot of the same things you do as well.
Yeah. Well, we kind of come from the same kind of place. He grew up in Mansfield, Ohio. I grew up just outside of Youngstown, Ohio, in Niles. Went to school in Warren, another industrial town. You know, like I told Sherrod, I think the more people on the stage talking about workers and working class issues, the better for our party. That's a that's an opportunity for us. I think we've lost a lot of the workers over the last few years. President Trump came in and talked about trade and other issues that were that killed manufacturing areas like ours. So the more Democrats we have talking about those things, I think the better.
Bernie Sanders is in. He's got name recognition, obviously. He's got now 6
Who?
Million right off the
Never
bat.
Heard of
Who?
The guy.
Kamala Harris, others that are in. They're going to have bigger bank accounts than you. They're going to have bigger name ID than you. How do you compete with them for the nomination?
Well, you go back to Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Donald Trump. I mean, nobody thought any of them had a chance to win. So my bet would be conventional wisdom never really works out. Front runners never really stay the front runners. And that's been the history. That's been the consistent history. And I think it comes down to, especially in these early states that I know pretty well. I mean, having gone to law school here and, you know, Iowa is very much a Midwestern state. I know the people of these communities, and I think if they get an opportunity to meet me, they would give me a chance, and there would be plenty of time to do that over the course of the next, you know, 11 months, I guess now, 12 months.
So it may be good for the issues that you're espousing and talking about working people to have both you and Sherrod Brown in the race, but wouldn't you both be, in essence, taking votes from each other if you're both talking about the same things? Yeah, the issues would win, and it would be brought to the forefront, and perhaps you'd change the platform. But in terms of each other's chances of having success, don't you see each other taking votes from one another?
I mean, there probably would be some of that. You know, does Joe Biden get in? Does he not get in? Who's a Bernie Sanders voter, Sherrod Brown voter, Tim Ryan voter? And then who could make the pitch? Who can put it all together? And I mean, that's what campaigns are for. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think we need to like figure everything out right now. Mm-hmm. I think it's fun to talk about. I'm a, you know, political junkie like you guys are. Mm-hmm. So it's fun to talk about. But at the end of the day, it comes down to who connects to the voters. Who do the voters believe in? Who do they think they could be the leader of the country and make a difference and operate on their behalf? That's what the campaign's all about, and that's why it's so much fun for all of us.
So, but I'm interested in your thought process as you kind of contemplate the decision, though, because do you look at it and say, okay, I have a skill set that is better than everybody else in this field when you make the determination? Is it, you know, the issues that need to get talked about? What leads you to say me instead of, you know, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Sherrod Brown, and not just sit back and say, you know what, there's all these other candidates and this seems to be taken care of. You know, what am I going to bring different to the race that the others aren't?
I know that my experience, both living 45 years of my life in Northeast Ohio and watching this economic train wreck happen to my family, my friends, my community, gives me a very unique perspective on what, you know, people are going through. I think people that are struggling economically, communities that are struggling, are going through. And in that 16 years in Congress, I've been working extremely hard to try to rebuild these communities. So what are the technologies of the future? What are the businesses of the future? What's the future of work? What's the future of education? I've been on the front lines of trying to build this in the middle of the Rust Belt my entire political career, which is now going, you know, I'm on my 17th year in Congress and 2 years in the state Senate. So I think that gives me a very unique perspective of where we've been, how we got there, where we are now, and really where we need to go. And I think that is something that we've yet to put together as a party, or really as a country. Neither party has been able to put that thing together. And the reality of it is there's an industrial revolution happening now, and we're not participating fully in it. We're losing this to China. And I think what we need to do, and I think this is what I would bring to the table, is that we can't run from the technologies. We can't run from artificial intelligence. We can't run from additive manufacturing. This is the future. We need to wrap our arms around it, take these new technologies, implement them, and help implement them into the old industries, increase productivity like crazy, which we can do with these new technologies, and then cut the worker in on the deal. Mm-hmm. So that the worker is going to benefit from the productivity increase. Train them, skill them up, but cut them in. The productivity has been going up significantly over the last 30 years, and the worker hasn't seen a lick of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got to put this whole thing together, and that includes talking about reforming our education system, which really we're not talking a whole lot about right now either, because that's the pipeline for the new economy. That's kind of what I feel like I would bring to the table.
It's Congressman Tim Ryan joining us here on the New Hampshire Now program. We've seen a dramatic shift in Washington, D.C., and a freshman class in the United States Congress that is generating a tremendous amount of attention and excitement. And as you know, I expected, you know, the 2018 midterm elections was about a number of individuals who felt that their stake in America had been challenged by President Trump, and new individuals ran and won, and now they're coming into Congress and looking to make, you know, an impact. What do you see the freshman class, you know, bringing to the table? And is there a danger, though, that you have a powerful, you know, minority within the Democratic caucus that is assuming this power? And we saw something similar, obviously, with Republicans and the Tea Party and how they were able to halt progress in a lot of different ways and to, you know, change the trajectory of the country as a minority group. Is there a danger of that happening with this group?
Well, there's always that danger, I think, today with the fractured media and social media. There's always that danger. But, you know, we have a very diverse freshman class. I mean, when you take 25 or 30 of the members that came, one in red districts, Trump plus five, Trump plus mm-hmm. 10 in Michigan, in Virginia, all over the country, and they won. And they're more center left. And then we also have the progressive, a handful of progressives, AOC and others. And that, again, that's politics. How do you pull this whole thing together? So I have no problem with what some of the progressives are doing with throwing out really bold ideas and bold visions, because that's kind of what we need right now when you talk about the green new jobs and all of that, which I don't agree with everything in it. But I think saying, look, climate change is real. It's a threat, and we better do something about it. We're now having that conversation. Now, whether it's, you know, line by line of what the resolution said or not, the conversation is now about how do we deal with climate change and make it an economic opportunity in areas like mine. So I think these big ideas are fine to have these conversations. And the legislative process, you always got to massage it and figure out, you know, where the sweet spot is as far as pushing it forward. We saw this with the Iraq War back in the day when I first got into Congress. Everybody wanted out of the war. But it was like, well, how do you unwind a war when you have a Republican president? What's the sweet spot? You had Dennis Kucinich on the far left, and then we had 50 blue dogs, center left Democrats who, you know, voted for the war and wanted to support the surge or whatever it was. So how do you balance that? That's the trick.
Those blue dogs are pretty much all gone now from the party. That's a dying breed. I'm wondering, especially with Bernie Sanders now, when you talked about the Green New Deal, Medicare for all, in many ways, this is almost a Christmas present for Republicans. They're painting the Democrats, they're painting you guys as extremists, as socialists. Are you concerned that things like the Green New Deal, Medicare for all, are going to label the party in a negative way?
So we have a number of blue dogs who won in this past election. So we went from 12 to 25 or something like that. And I think we've got to be very careful. I think we come off sometimes as hostile to business. And look, if anybody should be hostile to business, it's a guy like me from where I come from, right? We've seen the devastation of trade deals and globalization and supply-side economics. But we got to come together. We're not going to solve these big problems without coming together, and that includes being engaged with the business community. You can be hostile to greed. You can be hostile to income inequality. You can be for raising rates. You know, you could be for taxing capital instead of labor, however we get there. But you can't be hostile to business, because 98% of businesses are small business people. Like, they're operating these mom-and-pop shops here in downtown Concord or downtown Youngstown, or running, you know, a tool-and-die shop in Youngstown. That's the vast majority. We can't green the economy without the power of the free market system. That's the most innovative thing we have. That's what we have that China doesn't have. That's what we have what many of these European countries don't have. So we can't, you know, cut our nose off to spite our face here. We've got to say, look, it's imbalanced. Business has way too, especially big corporate businesses, have way too much power. They've been crapping on their workers for years, seeing them as a variable that they just have to deal with. We've got to say, look, here's our goal, reverse climate change, reverse global warming. We all got to sit at the table and figure out how to do it. And guys like me need to say, and the damn worker needs to be cut in on the deal. We're not going to keep doing this where the average person is stuck. And we're all part of solving this problem. Same with healthcare, same with energy. All of these things, we've got to come together.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Congressman Eric Swalwell from California is next. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.
So joined by Congressman Eric Swalwell, who's back in the Granite State. He's looking at running for president and is close to making that decision. And you know, as you look at making that decision, what is the main impetus behind doing it? And when you think about all the other candidates that are in the race as well, some of them were regional candidates here to New Hampshire and the Northeast. How do you go about formulating a campaign, and what is the impetus behind getting into it?
For me, Chris, and thanks for having me on the show.
Appreciate you coming in.
It's, can I make a difference in the lives of every American? Mm-hmm. And second, do I see a path to win? I mean, if I've got ideas that can make a difference, but I don't see a path to win, then why go through the sacrifice and take a young family with you while doing it? But I do see that I can make a difference. And that's what the vision of going big on the issues we take on. No mm-hmm. more governing crisis to crisis, being bold with the solutions we offer, meaning that on healthcare, on gun violence, on student debt, that we make significant progress that someone could feel in the first term of a new presidency, and doing good in the way that we govern, no longer governing by transactions, but being collaborative and cleaning our government of dirty maps and dirty money. So go big, be bold, do good. I see myself as a candidate that could do that. I'm connected to everyday Americans myself, the first in the family to go to college, mm-hmm. got student loan debt, a young family. I feel these issues, and I hear people who are struggling with them, and I connect with them because it's a struggle I lived and still live today.
Last time you were here, you mentioned you were about 90% towards getting into it. 95%, 99%, or still where you're at right now?
Well, look, it's February, and I could be home with my kids, but I'm here.
Yeah.
And, it's hard to leave your wife. She's got a full-time job, too, but we know that, these issues are important, and, families are counting on someone who's going to deliver. And so I'm going, to Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada just a couple days ago, and very close to making a decision. But, I don't feel the rush to, announce yesterday or tomorrow. I think you want to make sure you're prepared so that when you get in, it's impactful and you can actually win.
You'll be happy to know that there's three coffee shops within walk distance of the Main
That's
Street
right.
studio.
That's
and
good.
The Trump Tower is nowhere close to here. Did you have any expectation that that was going to go? We're talking about a brief Instagram post that you had, which went viral, and everyone started talking about. Did you have any expectation that was going to take place?
No, and I was, rightfully ribbed for that. Twitter and Instagram are fun outlets. Sometimes to just, be light, be cheeky. And if you're going to dish it, you better be able to take it. And there were some pretty funny responses to my bewilderment in snowy Manhattan as I refused to go to Trump Tower. But apparently there are 100 coffee shops within a stone's throw away that I could have gone to. So, I love those platforms. But, winning the presidency can't rely on just Twitter, though. And that's why I'm here, is, going doorstep to doorstep, Main Street to Main Street, farmer's market to farmer's market. Granite Staters want you to look them in the eye and tell them what you're going to do to make their lives better.
I certainly agree, but we have seen a marked change, just over my time covering the New Hampshire primary here. And my first primary was back in the 04 cycle. And one of the major changes is social media and how candidates go about, utilizing social media. We saw, Cory Booker and Kamala Harris in the Jussie Smollett situation
got out ahead of that and didn't wait for the facts to come in and said things that were really, really strong based upon, you know, what was taking place. And there's this, you know, immediacy, like you were just doing an Instagram video. You're obviously the Instagram video around Trump Tower. And so how do you go about – that's one of the main aspects of managing the campaign is that now you have followers and you can communicate directly with those individuals. And, you know, in doing so, there's kind of a – you know, you want to. You face a lot of the same questions we do in media. Where do you wait? Do you say something? Do you condemn something instantly? How do you go about it? Because that could make or break a campaign if you get out ahead of something too quickly.
I think the most important thing to do on social media is just be yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, authenticity, you know, matters. I think people can tell if it's you posting or if it's a cautious staffer. So right. I think authenticity is important, and also owning your mistakes. You know, the great thing about social media is if you screw up. You can immediately say that you screwed up, and it's a very forgiving place, mm-hmm. I find. It rewards people who are like, hey, that actually was – I was wrong when I said that. Mm-hmm. I've had to do that before. I've said things or have tweeted out something, you know, in a moment of frustration. But it, just as it was wrong, if I said something wrong, I think immediately following up and saying I was wrong, you know, is okay. Like that – that's the good thing I think about this platform is, you know, it has democratized communication.
In your job as a representative, you sit on the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, also Judiciary, and Adam Schiff was on TV earlier today as we taped this on Sunday, as you're here in Concord, talking about what would take place should the Mueller report not be issued in full to Congress, that he would, as expected, Representative Schiff would subpoena Robert Mueller to speak in front of the committee in Congress. Do you agree with that? And, you know, do you see – obviously you're going to agree with it, but what do you see as the impetus and the power that Congress has to make sure that they get – the full report, because that's a big concern for people across the board, is that the Attorney General is going to issue a report on the report, and you know the report may not get to Congress's into Congress's hands or into the public light.
I'll believe the Mueller report is complete when I hear from Bob Mueller that the report is complete, and from no one else. So that may mean that he'll have to testify before Congress and say so. Now, the reason we're so interested in a thorough report is because the rule of law has had a wrecking ball taken to it, and we want to make sure, you know, that we take a damage assessment to see if it still stands and that Mueller was able to follow all of the evidence. But, you know, we have in serious question whether a candidate for president, someone who is a president-elect, and whether someone who governs today as a president has been compromised by the Russians. And then there's a separate question if he's abusing his powers and obstructing justice as that investigation goes on. This is, you know, the rule of law is the long pole in our tent of democracy that allows all the freedoms we enjoy. And if it is collapsed by an abusive president, everything we enjoy can go away. So I think we have to make it clear that we're always doing this because of the rule of law. It's not personal to any one party or candidate, but it's just the foundation of what gives us you know, the benefits in our lives, the things we can count and the things we can't.
The Mueller report, and again, we don't know whether it's completed, as you referenced, or exactly what is going to be in it, obviously. But it is, you know, in my view, a centerpiece for what Democrats want to do in regards to impeachment. And has been, you know, as we've talked with our representatives here in New Hampshire and our senators, where they want to see that report pushed forth because it's very important that for the future of our country, that a independent investigation is what is seen as what brings about impeachment, a fact-driven investigation, as opposed to, you know, Democrats pushing forth and saying, well, this is wrong, and Republicans saying, no, you guys are going too far, this is overreach, and the president screaming that it's a witch hunt. And you know, the integrity of the Mueller investigation and protecting that integrity and having that report lead, to me, is so important. So the fact that the Attorney General would not allow for that report to become public, to me, is harmful to American democracy, because that integrity and that independence, in my view, is so integral moving forward. Because if it's a Democratic, if Democrats say, well, the emoluments clause, the president did this, and he's, you know, he is engaged in this type of behavior, it's beneath the presidency, that brings about question, and you create an environment where it's a pendulum swing, where Donald Trump does one thing, Democratic elected president does another, and we judge based upon that as opposed to having the independent investigation.
Yeah, so first I'll say we're on the sunset side of the Donald Trump presidency. It's just a matter of whether he's removed by Congress or removed at the ballot box. But he's not going to be around on January 20, 2021. Now, if he crossed some bright red lines that this investigation is able to show, then we have a responsibility to move on that, because again, the rule of law is sacred in our country. I also want to be mindful, though, that we should not conduct Donald Trump justice. If this was Donald Trump justice, Donald Trump would be impeached by now. But we're not going to jump to conclusions, as he does, as he, you know, makes statements all day on Twitter or in the press. We're actually going to give him a fairer investigation than he probably deserves. We're going to do it in a way that we follow evidence. We're going to seek bipartisan buy-in, and we're going to make sure the American people knows what is at stake. And as it relates to the Mueller report, we will see it, and we'll see it because we're no longer powerless. The American people, by giving us Chris Pappas here in New Hampshire and sending Annie Custer back, they will ensure that we have a majority in Congress that is able to put balances of power on these abuses of power. So we're going to see that report. It's just a matter of when.
How can you be sure of that? Like, what powers are going to be used, and how are you going to make sure the Attorney General does in fact submit the report? As you referenced, you know, Bob Mueller can be, as I referenced, Bob Mueller can be subpoenaed in front of Congress, and he can issue, you know, the report. But that is something that is, quote unquote, owned by the Justice Department, and they can make the claims of, oh, this is we can redact this. We can, this is something that meets executive privilege, or all these different aspects to make sure that perhaps things are hidden, which was the concern about having, you know, an independent Attorney General. And of course, there's concerns about Barr based upon what he has mentioned before. So how can you ensure that we will see the full report?
The president's outnumbered. We have a legislative subpoena power where if the president objects to it, we have precedent in the courts. So the legislative branch and the judicial branch will outnumber him. And we believe we're on firm legal ground that we'll see that report. Again, he may tie us up in the courts for a little while, but we're getting that report.
That is Representative Eric Swalwell joining us here inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio here on the New Hampshire Now program. This hour of the show is brought to you by Reuben Community Mental Health. And this segment of the program presented by the Burgess at Concord, New Hampshire primary interviews brought to you by Rath Young and Pignatelli. So you mentioned that Donald Trump's days are essentially numbered, whether it's impeachment, whether it's, you know, he is taken out by the ballot box. And I tend to agree with you, but I think that there is, and if you look at the numbers, which we've seen most recently, the president is not looking good for 2020, but he's up against Candidate X, and Candidate X always looks better as Candidate X than as an actual individual, and particularly one where Donald Trump is going to drag them through the mud and take the lowest road back to the White House, as he took that lowest road to the White House to begin with, in my view. Yes, things would look good now for Democrats, but if you have an individual who, you know, espouses views that are able to be labeled as socialist, or if they are, such as Bernie Sanders, labeled themselves as a Democrat socialist, and it becomes, you know, Donald Trump fighting for capitalism and America versus a new view of America, when a lot of people may not like the way things are headed, but think that America is on stable ground in regards to the economy, and a huge shift may change that. So, as you look at running for president, is there a concern about who the Democrats nominate? Or do you feel that whoever runs, the Democrat is going to have success against Donald Trump?
We need to nominate someone who can beat him. I'll speak for myself. I can beat him. Mm. I see and hear the people who believe that this is a top floor economy and that they are not connected to opportunity. He talked about connecting them to opportunity in 2016, and many of them went for him because they thought he would deliver. Today, where we stand now, about two-thirds of Americans have less than $1,000 in their savings. 78% of Americans are working paycheck to paycheck, and 40 million Americans have $1.3 trillion in student loan debt. So I would make the case that those are all valid concerns that you had in 2016. I see you. I hear you. I am for you. Mm-hmm. And he cannot deliver for you. And so you're going to need a go big, be bold, do good leader in this country. And I could do that. I can't speak for the others. I see a lot of candidates who I think can beat him. But the most important trait, I think, has to be someone who can beat Donald Trump and lift up the lives of so many people who are counting on a leader but haven't had that in the last 4 years.
You've listened to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.